Well, hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Join me, Sam Harris, on my journey of curiosity and growth. I have conversations with some of the world's most fascinating humans, from billionaires to Olympians, and most everyone in between, such as suspiciously happy people and even a hitman. Success isn't just for successful people, it is earned and you can earn it too. I find out how ordinary people become extraordinary to fuel your own growth mindset. Today I'm interviewing Margaret Rutherford, who is an author and runs a podcast and just generally seems to be a very useful person for understanding yourself and kind of healing and dealing with depression and anxiety, and a very useful person to be talking to right now in this current time. So I guess I like to start my podcast episodes with a bit of an introduction from the guest, so like a 3-minute life story of who you are. Yeah, so we're all on the same page.
Well, I have a very famous name there in Britain. You know, Dame Margaret Rutherford was quite the actress, and I think she was a dame. Anyway, people have said, oh, you have a famous name. I'm a clinical psychologist. Actually, in my 20s, I was a professional singer. I sang jingles, which are radio and television advertisements, when I was younger. And so I spent a lot of time in front of a microphone. And then I sang jazz at night, and I loved doing that. I loved music. I loved performing, but I didn't particularly like the lifestyle. So I heard about this thing called music therapy. And I went to a university in Dallas, Texas. And in fact, that's where I was living, and studied music therapy. But then when I actually did my last internship as a music therapist, it was at a psychiatric hospital. And that's where I discovered what I really wanted to do. I had been in therapy in my 20s because I was living a fairly chaotic lifestyle as a musician, must admit. And therapy had really helped me. In fact, it's one of the reasons I think I recognized that that kind of life was just great for some people. It wasn't great for me. In about 8 or 9 years, I went from closing down the Fairmont Hotel at night with my jazz group to 8 or 9 years later, seeing my first patient. And I've always thought that being in the quote unquote real world and not necessarily being a psychologist all my life really has given me a way of reaching a lot of people. I'm a pretty direct, kind of common sense kind of therapist. I love being a therapist. I never planned to do any social media. I never planned to write a book. And then my son left for college. I started blogging. That was back in 2012. Then I started the podcast, which is called the Self Work Podcast with Dr. Margaret Rutherford, and in 2016. And I absolutely love doing that. And then in 2014, a little bit before that, I had written a blog post called The Perfectly Hidden Depressed Person, Are You One? And it went viral. I had hundreds of emails that came in when it appeared on the Huffington Post and saying, this is me. How did you figure this out? It's like you're in my head. And I know we're going to be talking about perfectly hidden depression more, but I started researching, and what, 5.5 years later, it was a book. So here you have it. That's my life. And I have a lovely husband and one son who's 25.
Yeah, I love just hearing how people lives happen, because I telling them backwards sort of makes sense, but often sort of as they're going along, it's sort of a bit of a, well, I just sort of did this because it felt kind of right and I wasn't really sure, or like something happened, and yeah, it's just quite interesting. But thank you.
I'm a good model for you can always turn your life around if you put enough determination behind it.
Often people kind of start doing these things and then they just feel a bit stuck that that's what they're doing, but then they're just sort of completely changing and going into therapy and something that sort of, obviously, as a student, you'd never have thought you'd have ended up doing if I tried to tell you this is what you're going to become in like 20 years time. You thought it was bonkers kind of thing. So what first made you make the decision to take music then as your major?
Actually, music was never my college major. My parents did not want me to be a musician. They thought musicians were weird and led horrible lives and didn't make any money. And most of them don't make a lot of money. So I never majored in music. I never majored in psychology. I was a French major in school, actually, in my college years, which was very helpful to me. Although I love the French language and lived in France for a little bit. But I chose music therapy, or at least that's the way I started this journey, because while I was working as a jingle jazz singer, they needed volunteers at the battered women's shelter in Dallas. And I was up. In fact, they needed someone to cover the 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. shift on the crisis line. And I knew that I closed the hotel at 1 o'clock and I was up, and sometimes I would stay up because it was hard to go to sleep. So I started volunteering at the battered women's shelter. And that's where I learned this enjoyment and actual great fulfillment of trying to help people who were in need. And that, coupled with my unhappiness with the lifestyle I was living, just caused me to go in another direction. So that's how I got there.
Yeah, random sort of chances that happened to be there, which you kind of took.
was it sort of like one night you just had the realization as you're doing this, like, wait, I really love this. This is what I should be doing with my life?
No, in fact, I often tell people or suggest to people, I hopefully don't tell them things, but I suggest that you can get so paralyzed if you think, okay, this is the right direction I want to go. I mean, I have to find the right direction before I take a step toward it. And it's paralyzing. It's staggering because you can be so filled with anxiety that you don't move at all. So certainly when I put all the money I had in the world down on my first year at Southern Methodist University, or SMU as we call it here, I put all my chips in, you know, luckily got a graduate assistantship, but I thought music therapy would be fine. But as the more I learned about music therapy and that whole psychological world, I realized that it was really psychology that I wanted to do and actually be a therapist myself, because therapy had helped me so much. So I started out in a direction of being a music therapist, and then I went in the direction of being a psychologist, and that took me, of course, years. And then what I discovered along that path, well, I got divorced and remarried all during that period of time. So my husband had moved from the Northeast to be with me. He wasn't happy in Dallas, so that landed us in Fayetteville, Arkansas. And I had never wanted to be a mom, and all of a sudden I really loved this man, and I thought, oh, I want to be a mom. So I had a kid in my late 30s. So yeah, everything has been just an unfolding sort of.
Yeah, I really like the sort of philosophy that you don't need to know where you're going, because it's so hard to know like the future anyway. But generally, if you're just working towards something, when you know what it is, you get somewhere, rather than when you kind of have a specific direction, you often don't even know that's the direction you want to end up in. So you kind of just don't do anything.
Well, you know, there's a quote in my book, I think it's Doctorow, D-O-C-T-O-R-O-W, but it's something like, you can go on a complete journey only being able to see where your next step is. You just take one step at a time. Actually, he uses a car as an analogy and says the headlights can only show you the next few feet, but that's really all you need to see. You just keep going those next few feet. And then you trust yourself and you learn how to deal with what's going on in the moment. And boy, is that ever important right now. I read a Facebook post this morning that was saying, from a mom who was saying, I'm a planner. I have to know what's going to happen in the next few months. I've always been one step ahead of the game, or five steps ahead of the game. And all of a sudden, we don't know if we're going to get sick. We don't know if someone we love is going to get sick. We don't know what schedules are going to be like, our own, our children's, nothing. To call it an opportunity is probably being a bit naive, but it's certainly a time when the more you stay in the moment you're in and just do your best then and begin to imagine what's in the future, that's fine, but you can't necessarily count on it.
Definitely. As in like, well, the kind of art of happiness is sort of about not expecting things and learning to appreciate the moment you're in, like the whole power of now, kind of the future is just something in your imagination and the past is just something in your imagination. Like the only thing that actually ever exists is now, and just learning to enjoy now is pretty essential. So it's an interesting one to see how people are coping with it, and hope that people do learn to be more focused on what they can enjoy and stuff. I'm trying to do things myself at the moment, and after the first month of being in lockdown, it was sort of, was kind of enjoying it, but I felt like I could be doing more useful stuff. And like, I've had a lot of adventures in my life and things, and obviously not doing any of those besides the old adventure of just being at home the whole time, was like, okay, maybe I can like do some kind of projects myself. So I started like a thing called Thrill Seekers Adventure Club, where just me and mates and anyone who wants to join, kind of just set ourselves stupid challenges for the week. I didn't eat for 2 days, and then spent the rest of the week doing this really hard press-up challenge on the hour, every day, just to see what would happen. And it was like, well, I'm just going to have to keep on doing press-ups, even though I don't want to. And it was really interesting. And like, I'm eating only porridge for every meal, which is, I don't know, it's completely stupid, but it's really interesting as well. And it just definitely makes it easy to just sort of be happy for what I have. So the first day I was like only oats and water. And then like the second day I was like, well, I'm going to let myself put some things in it. And I was very appreciative of just slightly different flavors of porridge suddenly. Whereas if you told someone that they had to eat like only different flavors of porridge for a week, they might like be quite annoyed. But if you sort of just go and do it, you can like be quite grateful for it. So just like weird psychological hacks that you can kind of put yourself through.
I think that's fascinating. I have a closed Facebook group. We've got a list going on about things that can help. I'll have to suggest that to them. I think that's a wonderful idea to just kind of do something really strange, something not akin to that really. But I'm a member of a gym here in my hometown. And, you know, I have workouts that I do, but theirs are different than mine. They make me do things I don't really want to do. And so I'm following their workouts, which is different. I would do the same thing over and over again. And they challenge me more. So that's great. Good for you and your mates, as you call it. We don't use that word in the United States, but that's great.
Anyway, enough about me. You went into therapy. Besides your book, what have been the other big things that you've learned about people and like why they go to therapy and what's the best ways to help them? Do you have like some standard different sort of personalities that appear and what their problems are?
Well, I think overall, I remember learning in graduate school that therapists were change agents, is what they called it. And basically, if there is a thread that runs through all patients, I mean, they come in for a myriad of reasons. They come in for depression, they come in for eating disorders, they come in from psychosis, they come in for anxiety, they come in for relationship issues, they're getting divorced or something unwelcome has happened, their child has died. There's so many different kinds of things, it's a little hard to say what is true about them all, but they're going through something that is overwhelming their skill set. Something has happened to them, they've done something, they're experiencing something that they don't know, they don't have the skill, the competence to deal with it. So it's overwhelming them, it's debilitating them, it is demoralizing. And so what you want to do is try to either help them learn new skills that they don't know how to do, or they've never thought of, or they need to read about it, they need to write about it, whatever. But a therapist, a psychologist, and other kinds of mental health professionals, hopefully, has learned both from whatever schooling they went to, but you know, you learn a lot, just like in every profession, from the people that you work with. So you want to help them move in a direction that they want to move, or sometimes you have to help them see another direction that they could possibly move. For example, with panic attacks, people will walk in and say, I need to get rid of these. And one of the things I've learned, because I have panic disorder, is that you don't get rid of panic attacks by hating them and wanting to get rid of them. And that's something usually people don't realize. They say, well, why would I accept their presence if I want to get rid of them? And yet acceptance is often the way you actually manage something or learn to work with something, because you accept its presence in your life. You might not like it, but you can accept it. But anyway, enough about that. So basically, therapy is about change. It's about insight, and insight is very helpful to people, meaning they can sort of begin to think about how their past may be affecting their present, or beginning to connect the dots in different relationships they've chosen, or they can see when their depression started or the anxiety started and what tends to trigger it. They can talk about the trauma that's caused them post-traumatic stress disorder, and we can work through that trauma and go over that trauma again in a hopefully supportive way. But the whole point of any of that is to help them change their behavior. I'm a firm believer, Sam, that insight is a wonderful thing to have, but where you get your hope is from changing your behavior. Seeing yourself have the same sadness or have anger or have fear or whatever your feeling is or your thought is, and to gain a better response to it so your life is more stable and more secure. That's a lot.
Yeah, it's quite a few different directions to go in from that. As in, if there was one thing that you could teach humans that would then stop so many people that to then need therapy, what do you think that one thing would be?
Well, people do horrible things to each other, and especially to their children. Trauma is part of so many people's lives, and so many women are sexually abused and men are sexually abused. The harm that people do to other people, I think that many of the problems we have would be far less severe. And then, of course, just good self-care. I mean, there are a lot of people who count on medications too much to change their mental status, and they don't get regular exercise, and they don't eat well, and they don't have a spiritual life of some kind, and they don't know how to be mindful or meditate. There are things that you can do that you are in control over, that if you do those things, they greatly influence how the status of your mind and your heart. I also think, you know, Dr. Brené Brown's work is very important here, and I've tried to follow that up with Perfectly in Depression, is that so many cultures believe that you never reveal vulnerability. That's frailty, or there's something wrong with that. And actually, it's my personal belief and my personal observation with the hundreds of people I've worked with, that the more comfortable you are with accepting your own vulnerabilities and not having any shame about them. I mean, for example, I'm a really impatient person, not with my patients, but personally, I don't wait in line well. I guess I'm very entitled and think I should go first. I was a spoiled brat when I was a kid, and maybe that has something to do with it. And my son will sometimes laugh at me and just go, Mom, you have a plane to catch? I mean, calm down. I'm very time oriented, and so I'm impatient. That's a vulnerability of mine. I also have strengths. I have a good sense of humor. And so my good sense of humor doesn't define me any more than my struggle with impatience impatience, nor does my struggle with impatience define me any more than my sense of humor. So what people believe is that if they reveal their vulnerabilities, if they say to somebody, yeah, I get really scared when X happens, or that really makes me mad and I don't know why, or I was abused as a child, or whatever the revelation is, they think that people are going to, or that they themselves then are defined by that. There is a hashtag called vulnerability is strength. And I totally believe that because I accept I'm impatient. And someone looks at me and goes, you know, Margaret, you're really impatient. I go, yeah, I know. I am impatient. Sorry if I'm being a jerk. But if I don't accept it, I'll get defensive. I'll say, I'm not impatient. What are you talking about? You know, I'm a very patient person. So if you accept what you struggle with and what your vulnerabilities are, then you can go with the flow more. You don't have to get defensive. You can accept. It gives you a lot of power. It's actually empowering.
Glad I asked that question. And then also you went into panic attacks. That was really interesting what you said about accepting them, because I think half of the cause of panic attacks is the panic of having a panic attack kind of thing. And if you're not so worried about it happening, I don't think it's such a problem, I guess.
Do you know that on a personal level? Do you also have anxiety or?
Yeah, I never really used to suffer from it. But then I had this one episode last year, very long story involving someone getting slightly obsessed with me. And yeah, long story with knives and scary stuff and people maybe dying. Nothing truly bad happened. But yeah, when it was all kind of over, I sort of just had like a weird panic attack of it, like all coming out, because I kind of had to deal with all of these things. And then suddenly it was sort of over. But then like my brain just needed to like flush out all like the other half of it, if like maybe I'm the weird one. I kind of just went into this weird like 10 minutes. I felt like I had all the symptoms of panic attack inside me. It felt like I'd almost taken drugs or something.
Well, often when you're dealing with something like that, a very dramatic, frightening scenario, you don't process the feelings. You don't have time. You don't have energy. You just do what you need to do, but they're waiting for you, i.e. PTSD.
Yeah, but I definitely have sort of noticed what the feeling like is, if anything sort of anxious has then sort of come inside me, like I sort of noticed what that feeling is kind of thing, but haven't been too controlled by it or anything as of yet. I'm generally pretty calm about most things. I mean, I've been raped and arrested for things that I haven't done and quite a lot of stuff, and generally put myself in stupid situations and nearly died a few times and was quite chilled out about the whole thing. I'm always get a bit bored when things aren't going wrong, if that's a bad trait to have, I don't know. Probably something wrong with me a little bit. Then like I need a certain level of adventure regardless of what's going on. Things that are like normal and easy just have no appeal, you know what I mean?
You're a little bit of an adrenaline junkie.
Yeah, exactly that. I think that's the word. But yeah, so it's interesting to actually be on the other side.
Well, you make a great point, because the panic about panic is often becomes the problem. And so one of the things about accepting its presence is that you just expect it to be there. You just say, oh, okay, here it is. And that's my panic. And you start noticing where you feel it in your body. And then you just get very externally focused. But you don't go, oh my God, I'm having a panic attack, because you're going to fuel it. And your sympathetic nervous system is going to go nuts. So if you just try to calm down, then you'll do much better.
My flatmate had some terrible things happen, but then started getting a lot of panic attacks and stuff, and sort of seemed like she'd work herself up to things. And certainly other people that I know who seem to sort of make things worse for themselves by kind of worrying about the things that they're worried about. And you're like kind of like two problems when you only have one problem if you didn't worry about the worrying thing. It's very easy to just hit them with the logic or have the logic, but it doesn't always help when you just tell them that they're not helping themselves. And so yeah, trying to frame it in the right way is why I would kind of love to spend some time looking into how to become a therapist to sort of say these things better, because I'm quite upfront and direct, like you said, that you can be with sort of, I'll see the logic of why someone's being stupid and how they could help themselves.
I have looked at people and said before, well, this is what I do and I don't see any reason to change it. And I'll look at them and say, you're in a therapist office. You really think this is working for you? I'll be pretty direct and just say, well, you know, I can't convince you to change this, but I really want you to try to assess a little more objectively if it's working and if it's fine. But if it's not, then maybe you ought to consider that there might be other ways to go about something or do something or whatever.
That's cool. And so how do you deal with relationship issues? Do you have some people that you're like, well, what, these people should just never be together anyway, what are they doing? Like if they sort of fight to stay together, they're just hurting each other? Or do you always just try and help them sort of fix things?
I don't personally believe that it's a therapist's job to decide for a couple should they be together or not. I mean, there's some people who stay together for many reasons that I personally might not, or they get divorced for reasons I personally might not. But so my personal feelings about whether or not they have what it takes to be a successful couple is really not up to me to decide that. What it is up to a good therapist who has worked with couples a lot, and you have to be careful because not all people have gotten training in couples work. Some people just see couples and they've really never gotten any training for it. But basically what you want to help couples with, your job is to help both of them at least feel like you understand their perspective. You may not agree with their perspective, but that doesn't really matter. If you understand it and they feel understood, they're much more likely to give what you say credence, because you have at least supported them to the best of your ability in where they're coming from. Now, again, I mean, I've had people who have been abusive to their partner look at me and say, I'm just not abusive. And I know they are. And I have to, things like that, say, well, I'm not going to agree with you there, but can you tell me, what do you call it? I try to at least help them understand that I want to know how their minds work. But then what you're wanting to do is try to point out both common errors they're making. Are they very defensive with each other? Are they in constant conflict? Do they criticize each other all the time? Do they interrupt each other? Do they withdraw from each other? Are they too focused on their children and not focused on themselves? There are lots of problems. You help people see options. There are a lot of dynamics there.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. Thanks. So how did you then put all these things together to write your book? So you were writing a lot of different blog posts at the time, and then just the one took off?
A blog post, yes. I was just sitting in my sunroom, Sam, and thought about some people that I had seen through the years that were different. They were depressed, certainly, but that's not how they presented at all. They presented as worried, as overworked, as probably anxious, if they came into therapy at all. Some of these people I knew out in the community, but they didn't reveal much about themselves. And they would come into therapy perhaps, and remembering one girl, mainly what she wanted help with was she was about to marry somebody that she finally revealed to me she didn't want to marry, and how to help her get out of that situation. Come to find out, she was suicidal when she walked in my door, but she didn't tell me. She had a lot of trauma in her life as a child that she had never discussed with anybody. She had a severe eating disorder. She was anorexic. A beautiful girl, successful young woman, looked like she had the life working through that. It turns out that the boyfriend or fiance was abusive and sort of some other things going on. So basically, in working with her, the work was not to get her engaged in the external world, which is what your work typically is with somebody who's classically depressed. They're so focused inwardly that you want to help them focus outwardly. You want to help them internally, but you also want them to get re-engaged with their lives. That's not the case with perfectly hidden depression. With perfectly hidden depression, the task is to help people understand and get connected with their emotions and things that they have kept concealed, either consciously or unconsciously, for a long time. And this is very scary. It's usually perfectionism. This kind of perfectionism hides that depression because they just look like they have the perfect looking life. So they can hide for a long time. But what the people who came to me and talked to me about it told me that it's a very lonely and despairing life because no one really knows these people. So I wrote about that, long story short, and that's when the post went viral. It was incredible. Hundreds of emails. And I called the post "The Perfectly Hidden Depressed Person, Are You One?" And that got me interested in the topic. Perfectionism has been known to be a problem, a character trait that can cause a lot of problems for years. I mean, I didn't come up with that idea. But Terrence Real, who's a psychologist here in the United States, wrote a book called I Don't Want to Talk About It. And it was about covert depression in men. And he did talk about that you just can't see this kind of depression. It's different from regular depression. But to my knowledge, no one had hooked up the idea of perfectionism with depression. People thought that perfectionism is an anxiety kind of problem, but I actually think that it has roots in emotional trauma and the need to avoid that, deny it, discount it, all that kind of thing. And that's what the book is all about.
I did like the Vipassana Insight Meditation Retreat, which sort of certainly helped me just be a lot happier a lot more of the time and still get like kind of learning about some things, but generally get out of these things pretty quickly.
The book is actually a workbook. It's not just a describe it kind of book. It's a book because I've come up with a treatment strategy that I use actually with every patient. And there are over 60 exercises in the book to help people begin to break free from this perfectionism. So hopefully that's helpful.
Can you give an example of like a good exercise that you do in the book that's sort of really helpful for people?
Well, they start out pretty simple, but they get much harder. One of them is to come up with the rules that you follow this is the CBT stuff, the rules that you follow in your life, the musts, the oughts, the shoulds, the have tos, and you write them out. And then you decide, I mean, they can be everything, and begin to think, wait a minute, are these helping me? Are these productive rules in my life? Do they make sense now that I'm an adult? Or am I following them just sort of blindly because these are the things that I learned and was taught? Now, some of them you want to keep, right? Some of them you want to be kind. You want, you know, there are things that you learn that are very much helpful to you in your life. But people with perfectionism have a lot of rules they're following that are not particularly helpful in their life. Now, that's on down kind of in the middle of the book. So the first exercises are much more simple than that. Things like one of the first exercises is to draw circles that are within each other, and small circle first, and then a larger circle, and then a larger circle, and to actually begin to think about who your friends are. That's sort of a circle of intimacy. Who are the people that really know you well? Who's in the inner circle? Who's in the outer circle? And who's in the very outermost circle? And a lot of people with perfectionism, or that shaming kind of perfectionism, don't have maybe anybody in the inner circle because they keep a huge wall between themselves and anybody else.
Super into the whole rule thing. I think that's part of the example I just gave for the porridge eating challenge. Is sort of, we live in this sort of world where porridge is maybe for breakfast, but you have to eat something else for lunch and you have to eat something else for dinner. And it's sort of a stupid rule that we just lived our whole life in. And there's nothing saying you have to do it. You just do it. You follow it blindly. And it just helps give you that lens of like, there's all these rules around you that you've never thought about. You just accept it blindly, and just helps you realize these things to then make more choices. Just helps make you aware of these sort of stupid things that you never even realized existed, kind of thing.
I would agree. And some of them aren't so stupid. I mean, I must never share that I was abused. I must never talk about that one of my parents was an alcoholic. All these things that I can't tell you how many times people have been across from me in my therapy room and have said, I've never told anyone this because I wasn't supposed to. And the shame they feel and the fear they feel in saying it is palpable in the room. So it can be a very helpful exercise to allow yourself to have the freedom and the space to talk about your real experience in life.
Do you notice a difference between your clients that have read your book and the ones that haven't, in terms of how quickly they recover and progress through therapy?
Well, not all my patients need to read the book. When I was working with a lot of people as I was writing the book, they didn't have the book available. And you can certainly help them without having the book, but they have to realize that the perfectionism is a problem. And that's the first stage of change, is that awareness that something is a problem that you think is a strength. Most people think their perfectionism is a strength, and it can be, but not when it fits into the rubric of perfectly hidden depression.
Yeah, it can be really limiting. The same way you said, as in when you trying to think of your life path, it's hard to like start off. As in, if you're a perfectionist and you want to have the perfect life path, you obviously can never start, because if it's never going to be like what you want it to be exactly, because you can't quite define it.
And then if you're hiding, then you've got to look like it's perfect. You have to keep up this facade of the perfect looking life, because you're actually hiding the way you feel. So not only are your standards continuously going up, but or your expectations are continuously going up, you have to look like it's all a breeze for you. So all these strictures and rules, and probably the hardest part of healing is going back and connecting with some of those emotions that you don't even want to admit they exist at first. And the book takes you very slowly and carefully through that process, with a lot of suggestions that if this is getting too hard, you probably need therapy from a trained trauma specialist. So I am very conscious of the idea that I want to help people with this book, and I want to turn them on to this idea, and I want to give them some steps. But some of this may be too hard for them to do on their own. A lot of the people that came to see me because of this and are still coming to see me long before the book was published, I'd written lots of blog posts about it and had podcasts about it. So they heard me talking about it. And actually, it was wonderful working with them while I was writing the book, because I used a lot of what I was doing with them to enhance and hopefully write a better book.
I do quite like finding out how people go about on their writing processes. So did you kind of wake up every morning and kind of just write for 2 hours before everything started?
No, because I was carrying a full load of patients. So some days I could do that and some days I couldn't. I mean, a lot of times I would get up at 4:30 or 5 in the morning and write for a couple of hours, but not every morning. I'm not that organized. Sometimes I was too tired. As I was writing the book in 2018, I took a week, and actually editing. So I did this for a year and a half. I usually work 4 weeks in a month, but I would only see patients 3 weeks out of the month, and then would write a lot during that week.
I like that cycle. As in, have you heard about Cal Newport's like deep work philosophy about sort of time blocking sort of like weeks or months to kind of just focus on doing like one thing at a time. It seems like a good strategy because writing a book doesn't just sort of happen without deciding.
Parenting was difficult, but writing a book is the most difficult thing I've ever done professionally.
That's interesting. It's one of those things that, like, it's completely possible in the same way that like eating porridge every meal is completely possible, as in you just make porridge and put a spoon in it and eat it, but like the people don't do it. And in the same way, like, everyone can write some paragraphs or a page of text, and then to keep on doing that in something that ties together in a whole like long sequence into a book is just something that's actually much harder for a human to do is in like a long-term thing.
Well, and I had editors also. I thought writing the book was hard, and then came like 3 or 4 editors and I nearly tore my hair out. Hats off to editors, because they can keep a whole book in their head. The book is a much better book because of the editors I had, and New Harbinger is my publisher and they did a great job.
How did you go about getting a publishing deal?
I wrote a book proposal. I had to find an agent, which actually I lucked upon an agent through a mutual friend. And then the agent worked with me for months on the proposal because he said, well, this is okay. So that was several months in and of itself. Then we began pushing it to publishers. And frankly, a lot of the publishers were very interested, but they said 2 things. We don't think someone with hidden depression will buy a book because they're hiding. And 2, they said, you're a psychologist in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and nobody knows who you are, which is true. So that's why I started the Self-Work podcast. And then I asked these people who volunteered to be interviewed by me who had identified with Perfectly Hidden Depression. I said, would you buy this book? And they said, well, yeah, we definitely find a way to buy it. We buy the ebook so no one would know that we were reading it, or we'd say it was for our mother or whatever. But they said the title itself, Perfectly Hidden Depression, is so enticing to those of us who are doing this that we know we're hiding, or we sense we're hiding. Our gut is telling us we're hiding, but we also look like we have the perfect life, and that despair is why we'd buy the book. And for an unknown author, the book is doing pretty well, so that's good.
I think it'd be useful for a lot of people as something that needs to go onto my list.
It is available internationally. It'll take you a little longer to get it, but it is available.
Cheers. Have you had any people with like major anxiety with the recent coronavirus things, and what's been your main piece of advice for people? Because I mean, you mentioned that people just need to focus on that current times.
Well, I think you have to recognize how the trauma in the background, or perhaps it's in the foreground for you. Perhaps you have someone you love, or perhaps you yourself have been ill or whatever, but just all the changes and all the ambiguity, the backdrop of that is constant. And of course, if you obsess about it, people who are watching multiple channels or have multiple sources of reporting are doing themselves a great disservice. So you want to keep abreast of what's going on, but you cannot ruminate about it because you will go down the rabbit hole of anxiety. There's just no doubt about it. You know, limit your exposure to it. Do your best to provide structure. Be kind to yourself. Realize you're not a teacher and you're trying to work from home, and home is home. Home is not work. Give yourself a break. Do what you can. Hopefully your partner and you, or if you have one, are handling things well. Still practice good self-care. Laugh. Listen to podcasts. Whatever will help you distract yourself. And then just try to stay as much as you can in the moment, because definitely the people that I see are struggling the most are people who are these highly organized, way ahead of the game kind of people, and they are really struggling. So when people come into therapy, they're having to learn a new skill, and it's not one they particularly wanted to learn.
Hopefully we'll become a bit stronger because of this and learn some new skills.
I hope so.
Okay, then last few things. What is one of your earliest ever memories?
I don't know if I remember this because I've been told about it or because I actually remember it. It's this kind of mixture of things, but I was kind of sickly as a kid and they had to take me to the hospital a lot. And I remember falling out of a baby bed. I was leaning up against the baby bed and the side of it collapsed and I fell out. That's my earliest memory.
Wow. That's funny. Okay, what is one of the kindest things that someone has done for you?
Well, my husband's a very kind person. In fact, I wrote about this in a blog post 2 or 3 weeks ago. I was getting my second divorce in Dallas, and I was very, very ashamed. I got up early one morning and went jogging around this place called White Rock Lake. Actually, it wasn't very safe for me to do that. It was kind of stupid, but the sun was rising, and I saw this man in front of me, and he was fishing off the wharf, off this dock kind of thing. And he just smiled at me. And rather than running away and thinking, what's this man going to do to me? I just approached him, and I had been crying, and he could see that I'd been crying, obviously. He didn't ask me about it. I said, did you catch anything? And he goes, no, do you fish? And he handed me a pole, and we fished together for a little bit. And I started opening up to him, and he listened, and he said, honey, you're going to be all right. And I remember leaving and thanking him, giving him a hug. I never saw him again. And I will never forget his kindness to me that morning, because I was really having a hard time. So that's what comes to mind. I'm sure there are many other kindnesses that have been done for me, but that's probably the kind, especially from a stranger.
Yeah, I guess when you needed it most kind of thing.
Yeah.
But you never know when it might be that someone needs it most. So you should always be kind to people. I realized that I wanted to ask you a bit more about your divorces, because you said that you have people that sort of scared about these things and being vulnerable and stuff. And would you be willing to discuss that and like what caused them and how you kind of came to realize that?
Let's just say I was very immature in my 20s, and I made some choices that were not mature choices. In the first marriage, I ignored a lot of things that I shouldn't have ignored. And the second marriage was about trying to fix one mistake that I had made. And I actually turned out to make a much larger mistake by marrying this person that was not kind to me at all. And there are lots of reasons for that, but I unfortunately can't go into all of them right now.
It's been lovely having you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for being on the show. And
you're welcome, Sam.
Look forward to hearing more about you and hearing some of your podcasts, reading the book and these things.
Enjoy your porridge. A little cinnamon helps a lot.
This is true.
I hope you enjoyed the episode as much as I did. My goal for this podcast is to help make people happier and wiser, and I'm also working on a few other projects in the podcasting space to achieve the same thing. I run the Wiser Than Yesterday podcast with a friend, where we read and discuss a great non-fiction book a week. We talk about things like philosophy, psychology, the economy, self-improvement, and business. Books such as The Black Swan, Anti-Fragile, Invisible Women, How to Win Friends and Influence People. It's a great resource. Most recently, I've been building an app, Syncify. It's really to level up your podcast experience. You can connect with your friends in the app and listen to the same things. So you can listen live in real time with each other, or create shared playlists and catch up at your own pace. You learn so much more by discussing ideas with friends. It's really silly to listen alone. You can also discover and share brilliant episodes with ease without having to try and recommend podcasts in different apps and just it all getting lost and confused. So it's also good for combating isolation and mental health. I personally find social media quite antisocial, and I just don't find it easy to reach out to friends to chat for no real reason. But I do love doing things with other people, and listening to the same content means that I can naturally talk about the same things, and it just gives me that friend time without going out of my way. So I really hope that it can help you, and I just would love you to try out the beta version and help us build this. And obviously, do invite your friends. It's all about friends. So you can find out more about Syncify app by going to syncifyapp.com. Thanks for listening. Congratulations on listening to a whole episode of the Growth Mindset podcast. Before you race into another podcast, try pausing. Ask yourself, what have you learned? What could you change? How will you make that change happen? Did you press pause? Knowledge is useless without action. What did you learn? What should you change? And how will you make that change happen? You can tell us what you learned by contacting us through the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com. And feel free to connect with us or our guests, or just peruse the show notes. Our Instagram is @growthmindsetpodcast, or follow me @samjamsnaps for a daily reminder to stop using Instagram. If you enjoy random acts of kindness and want to support the show, you can support us on Patreon or leave us a review on iTunes, and you'll make me very happy. And with that, keep learning and keep growing.